there will be, they will return. And so there will be a restoration to the land. But I wanted to step back by way of introduction today before we move into Jeremiah 31 again. And we've noticed that there are two kingdoms. There's the northern kingdom, Israel. There's the southern kingdom, Judah. And as looking at this, we haven't gone back to notice why there were two kingdoms. And we've referred to it, alluded to it. But if we go back to 1 Kings chapter 11, we come to the account of Solomon and his reign. Now, Solomon was a king who started out well. And God gave him his wish to be the wisest man of his time. He was the wisest of men. And he also provided him with all of the wealth and all of the other things he could have asked God for. But he asked God for wisdom. And so he had that. But yet, Solomon, having started well, he then got sidetracked and he went down the wrong path. And he did evil in the sight of Jehovah. And he didn't do like his father David did, but he did evil, it says. And so we'll look at that just for a moment. Back in 1 Kings chapter 11, before we go back to Jeremiah 31. And this establishes where the kingdom is divided. And God allowed this to take place. Solomon knew better. But he went against God's command to him. And he got in trouble. And he got in trouble because of many strange women. That's a warning. But he had many strange women, it says. And so we'll come back and look at that. But I want to look at chapter 11 of 1 Kings just for a moment, a few moments. And we want to look at verse 11. Wherefore Jehovah said unto Solomon, for as much as this is with thee, it says it's done of these with thee, and thou hast not kept my covenant and my statutes, which I have commanded thee, I will surely rend the kingdom from thee and will give it to thy servant. And so the kingdom is going to be taken from Solomon. But the thing that was with him, back in verse 1, it does tell you what he did. It says, but King Solomon, in verse 1, loved many strange women, together with the daughter of Pharaoh, women of the Moabites, Ammonites, Edomites, Zidonians, and the Hittites. These were those that they were not to have anything to do with. And in the next verse, we see which nations they came from. They were from the nations concerning which Jehovah said unto the sons of Israel, ye shall not go in to them, neither shall they come in unto you. For surely they will turn away your heart after their Elohim. And the gods there in small case is good, small case, but it is Elohim. But it's after their gods, after their deities. Solomon clave unto these in love. And you see that he had 700 wives, princesses, and 300 concubines, and his wives turned away his heart. And for it came to pass, when Solomon was old, and his wives turned away his heart after other gods, and his heart was not perfect with Jehovah his Elohim, as was the heart of David his father. And so it goes on to describe the things that he did as he went after these other deities. And in verse 6 it says, and Solomon did evil, he did in the sight of Jehovah, and did not fully went not fully after Jehovah, as did David his father. And he built the high places where they had their idols and things in verse 7, and he did things that were evil. So in verse 9, Jehovah was angry with Solomon because his heart was turned from Jehovah, Elohim of Israel, which had appeared unto him twice. Now back in the beginning of our study of the appearances of Jehovah, the pre-incarnate Son of God, we noticed this, we came to this verse, that Jehovah had appeared to him twice. And we looked at the two occasions when he did meet with him. And it was a personal appearance, and it says he appeared to him. He appeared to him twice. And so this was a personal appearance to Solomon. and he commanded him concerning this thing that he should not go after other Elohim, other gods, but he kept not that which Jehovah commanded. And so God's going to take the kingdom away from him, but he's not going to do it in his lifetime, and because of David. And so he says that down in verse 12, notwithstanding in thy days I will not do it for David's, thy father's sake, but I will rend it out of the hand of thy son. And so he's going to take it away from David, from Solomon's son. Now, as we move on down through the context, we will go over to chapter 12 and verse 43. And here we come to David's son when Solomon dies. And Solomon slept with his fathers and was buried in the city of David his father. And Rehoboam his son reigned in his stead. And so Rehoboam steps in as king now. Solomon, remember, he started off well, but he was distracted because he went against what God told him. He married wives of the countries that they were not to participate with, and he actually took wives who influenced him. And so he got involved with idolatry. And so the kingdom was going to be taken from him. But Rehoboam now comes in as king. And just to summarize some of chapter 12, when the older men, the counselors of Solomon, came to Rehoboam, they told him he ought to lighten up on the people, cut the taxes. And the younger men who grew up with Rehoboam were told, they come to him and say, no, don't cut the taxes. You make it tough. You increase the taxes and you abuse the people. And so it wasn't popular, any more popular at that time than it is today. So he raised the taxes. In fact, he was quite arrogant. It says at the end of verse 10, or in the middle of verse 10, the young men said to him, thy father made our yoke heavy, but make thou it lighter unto us. That's what they said. Thus shalt thou, when the people ask him to lighten up on the taxes, but notice what the young men told him to say. Thus shalt thou say unto them, my little finger shall be thicker than my father's loins. And now, whereas my father did lade you with a heavy yoke, I will add to your yoke. My father hath chastised you with whips, but I will chastise you with scorpions. And so he's going to increase the taxes. He's going to increase the abuse of the people, which wasn't popular with his father either. But he's going to increase it. And so you see Jeroboam comes along with all the people, and and he didn't treat them well, we see in verse 13. But he says he's going to add to all of the things that his father did. In verse 14, he tells him just what his young counselors told him he should do with the people. And so we want to just scoot on down and look down to verse 16. So when all Israel saw that the king hearkened not unto them, and the people answered the king, what portion have we in David? Neither have we inheritance in the son of Jesse. To your tents, O Israel. Now see in thine own house, David. So Israel departed into their tents. So now you see a change. Now you have a division that's going to come. God said that the kingdom would be rent from Solomon, and so all of the kingdom was, except for two tribes. It's the house of David that's going to remain as the southern kingdom, but we'll see also that Benjamin was included in that. So in verse 19, so Israel rebelled against the house of David unto this day. And then in verse 20, you have the division. And it came to pass, when all Israel heard that Jeroboam was come again, that they sent and called him unto the congregation and made him king over all Israel. Now there was none that followed the house of David, but the tribe of Judah only. And then you do find they're with the tribe of Benjamin in the next verse and so on. But you had way back here, you had it back a long while before, the kingdom was divided because Solomon hadn't obeyed. And so we've had this divided kingdom, Jeremiah, his ministry has been to the southern kingdom, as we said. The northern kingdom has been carried off into captivity previously, but Judah, now they did the same as the northern kingdom, and so they will be carried off. But at the same time that they're told they're going to be carried away into captivity, at that very same time, we do find promises and prophecy concerning the fact that God will bring them back. And so that's what we're looking at in chapters 30 through 33 of Jeremiah. And so as we come back to these chapters, we will see that God is going to bring them back. But before, one thing I wanted to point out, and I neglected to do so while we were in 1 Kings, just wanted to go over to chapter 17, and that does describe when they were carried away by the Assyrians. The northern kingdom was carried off, and so they are out of the land. And in 17, 20 and 21, we do find that they were carried away. And I'm just going to jump into this. Wrong chapter. 2 Kings. That's why I said 1 Kings, and I should have said 2nd. Then I turned to 1 Kings. But 2 Kings 17, 20 and 21. And Jehovah rejected all the seed of Israel and afflicted them and delivered them into the hand of spoilers until he had cast them out of his sight. For he rent Israel from the house of David, and they made Jeroboam the son of Nebat king. Okay, we went back to that. And then they're going to be carried off. I had a wrong reference in my mind there. But they are carried off. How did I do that? Okay, over in verse 6, this is kind of verses 20 and 21 look back to what happened, but after this, in verse 6, that's what I wanted. In the ninth year of Hoshea, the king of Assyria, this is Hoshea, the king of Israel, the king of Assyria took Samaria and carried Israel away into Assyria and placed them in Hala and in Habor by the river Gozan in the cities of the Medes. And for so it was that the sons of Israel had sinned against Jehovah their Elohim, which had brought them up out from the land of Egypt from under the hand of Pharaoh, king of Egypt, and had feared other Elohim. And so the instance where they have been carried off, you can read more detail through the context back in the historical books there. But they were carried off. And so now chapter 31 did describe the return of the northern kingdom, as it's referred to as Israel and as it's referred to as Ephraim. And so they will be brought back. Interesting, because his ministry is to Judah. And and as we said, they're not yet in captivity. Now, down through verse 21, then we looked at it last week. The northern kingdom, they're going to be brought back. They're to come back. They're going to come back in the way that they departed. They're going to come back the same route, and they're to set up stones and markers along the way so that they can find their way back and return, he says. But yet, when we looked at this section, they're not just coming back from the Assyrian captivity. They're going to come back from wherever they are in the world, on the earth. They're going to be around the globe. They're going to be spread out. And so it goes beyond just an initial, more immediate return to the land. They will be brought back from wherever they are, and that's true of Judah as well. And they will come back as one united kingdom again. And as they come back as a united kingdom, God is going to establish, he's going to cut a new covenant with them. And so that comes up in the following section. Now, we'll talk about that when we get there. But if we come to verse 22 this morning, 22 through 36, you have the return of the backsliding daughter to the land of Judah. And he begins with a question here concerning their backsliding. And this is just before Christ will come and establish his kingdom. We would interpret it at that point. How long wilt thou go about, O thou backsliding daughter? Now, they went back and they went back in their ways. They had worshipped other gods and things. And this idea of backsliding was something, it was an Old Testament thing. But he goes on to say, how long wilt thou go about? And he addresses them as a backsliding daughter, for Jehovah hath created a new thing in the earth. And so this is a creation of something new. Now, this is kind of it's a passage that's a little bit misunderstood, and it's not something that there are a lot of different interpretations as to how a woman shall compass a man, but a female will compass, she will embrace, she'll surround is the idea, but she'll embrace a male. And it's kind of an unusual statement as we look at it. But I would just say that by the time that this takes place in the future, when this is stated and when this takes place, it just implies that there are not going to be very many males around left at this point, with all of the chaos and all of the destruction that will take place. But then in verse 23, you have a speech concerning Jehovah. And the blessing as the of the land. Thus saith Jehovah, and the word of hosts again is Sabaoth, that is, he's over the heavenly host, the heavenly armies of spirit beings, but he's also the Elohim, the God, the Elohim of Israel. As yet they shall use this speech. And so they're going to say this word in the land of Judah and in the cities thereof. So now we turn, this is our change of context now, from Ephraim, Israel, the northern kingdom, to the southern kingdom, and to the land of Judah. And in the cities thereof, when I shall bring again their captivity, Jehovah bless thee. This is what they will say. Jehovah bless thee, O habitation of justice, and mountain of the holiness. And so justice, this is going to be a place where righteousness will settle down. There will be righteousness, and the mountain of holiness is going to be a place that's set apart to God's rule and his government, as it's referred to here as a mountain of holiness, and a specific holiness. And there shall dwell in Judah itself. And so they're going to be in the land, and there's going to be provision for the people of Judah when they return to the land, and we see this down through verse 26. And there shall dwell in Judah itself, and in all the cities thereof together, husbandmen. So you're going to have those who are out plowing the fields. You'll have those who are settled down plowing fields, and they that go with the flock. So there will be crops. There will be shepherds with sheep, flocks of sheep. They will be taken care of. But at this time, in anticipation now, this anticipates after they've been carried away into captivity. And so he writes to them from the perspective of those who are captive, though they haven't been carried away yet, but they're very close to being carried away under Zedekiah. And so, for I have satiated the weary soul. And so he's caused them to be satiated, to be satisfied. And so they're going to just plain be saturated, the weary soul. Now, when it speaks of a weary soul, it looks at somebody, they're weary, and it's an emotional thing that they're weary when they're away. They're weary and they've been worn down where they are. As in captivity, and so he's caused them to be satiated, to be completely. They're going to have more than they need as the weary soul. But he says, I have replenished every sorrowful or faint soul, and so everyone whose their souls they were away. They're going to be away from the land. And so when this will be applicable to them, when he's going to bring them back in anticipation of bringing them back, they will know that he's going to give them all that they need. They're going to be more than satisfied with what they have. They're going to be saturated. There will be plenty of crops. There will be plenty of sheep. They'll have plenty when they get back into the land. It will be, and they won't be hungry. And their souls won't be faint. They won't be feeling faint as a result of captivity. But now he will replenish them anyway, is what he says here. And so they will be taken care of when they come back. They will have plenty of provision. Now, verse 26 is a little bit of a difficult verse again. But now Jeremiah speaks. Jehovah was speaking. I don't believe this is Jehovah continuing his speech. But it appears that as he spoke to Jeremiah, that he was perhaps asleep, and maybe it doesn't say he was dreaming here, but that almost sounds like it. He says, "Upon this I awaked," and so he hears that they're going to be brought back into the land, and so this woke him up. And he says, I looked, and my sleep was sweet unto me. And so what he saw here, it was something that was coming back into the land would be a good thing. Now, the false prophets, we've noticed before that had spoken to the people, and Jeremiah confronted them. They said, you won't be carried off. Everybody will be back, and everything will be back to normal. And it'll be right now. And so the one guy, he established it within 2 years. Everybody will be back. But it wasn't to be. They will be carried off into captivity. But now, looking out into the future and what Jehovah has promised in the future and the prophecy of the future is that they will be brought back, and God will meet their every need with an overabundance. And so there will be, and so he says, my sleep was sweet unto me. This was a good sleep, a good kind of a dream to have, because as God communicated this to him, that they would come back into the land. Now, at this time, that ends the little section dealing with the restoration of Judah back into the land and their needs being met, and as they're replenished at this time in the future. Now, when we move into verses 27 down through 30, we have the restoration of the house of Israel and the house of Judah now. And so this is quite important as we come into this. It says, "Behold, the days are coming, saith Jehovah, that I will sow the house of Israel and the house of Judah with the seed of man, the seed of Adam, and also with the seed of beast." So he's going to, the house, both houses are going to be sown with seed. And so it's the seed of mankind. There's going to be an increase of those who are in the house of Israel, the northern kingdom. There's going to be an increase in those who are in the house of Judah, the southern kingdom. And God's going to, again, he's going to replenish the people. So though they will end times, in the days that are coming, and the days that are coming is a phrase that does anticipate the prophetic future out in the future. And so it is anticipating out in the future when God will bring his people back. But when he does, these two houses are going to be sown with the seeds of Adam, of mankind, of man, Adam, and the seed of beast. There will be plenty of them. Now, we're going to see the days come again. We're going to see a similar phrase down in verse 31, and in verse 29 it refers to the days, those days. But it is anticipating out in the future, though, and it does deal with Israel, the nation Israel. They will have a seed increased. Now, when we look at the seed of seat of that, of these two houses combined. In effect, it kind of goes back to the Abrahamic promises in some ways. God did promise Abraham that his seed would have the land in Genesis 15. The seed of Abraham, his physical seed, would. When we get to chapter 17, it refers to, in the second covenant God cut with Abraham, that he would have kings and others who would come out, but it deals with his seed there. And so it does have to do with his seed, the physical seed. In the second part of chapter 17, beginning in verse 9, you have the conditional covenant, a third covenant that is conditional, and that is the covenant of circumcision. Again, that relates to the seed of Israel and all who live in the land of Israel. And when we get to chapter 22, it moves away from that physical seed. It goes to one seed singular, which is Christ. And we find that interpreted for us back in Galatians 3, verse 15 ties with it. But then it also, down at verse 28, goes to a singular yet multiple seed, which is not the physical seed as it's interpreted in Galatians 3. But anyway, the seed, though, it's going to go back to the promises to Abraham. Essentially, he's going to sow seed in both the house of Israel and the house of Judah, and so they will be a great people. And as we said, we noticed the verse within the last couple of weeks that Israel will no longer be the tail of the nations, they'll be the head of the nations. So they will be restored to that place where they will be a great nation, the head of the nation. And it's kind of interesting, that's not the way it is today. You have a little remnant of people who are Jews in the land, in the modern Israel, and you have everybody except most everybody in the world against them, and many who want to destroy them and blow them off the face of the earth. Just as on the news within the last couple evenings, they were referencing the possibility that Iran, if they get nuclear warheads, well, that's their whole intent, is to go down and wipe Israel off the face of the earth. Well, it might hurt some people's faith, but it wouldn't blow my faith that God will fulfill his promises to Israel, even if that happened. He will bring them back someday, whether it's now, whether it's in the immediate future, or whether it's in the far distant future, but God will fulfill his promises exactly as he gave them. But we do have the promises to Abraham and his seed will be fulfilled. They will have that land, but they will be sown there. There will be a seed of mankind in both houses. And a little later, we will see them come together. But they're going to both be great again. Verse 28, we have the reversal of the effects of judgment, and we have some negatives and positives in here. Verse 28, and it shall come to pass, or it will be, that like as I have watched over them. And so Jehovah speaks now as how he's going to watch. He has watched over them. But notice how he's watched over them. You start with some negatives. And the way he watched over them was they broke the law, and so they're going to pay the penalty. And so they're plucked up, he says, and you have a bunch of purposes for his watching over them: to pluck up and to break down and to throw down and to destroy and to afflict. And so you have, what, about five purposes here, but he afflicted them, and he watched them to do so. He watched them to do all of these things to his people because of their spiritual adultery, their idolatry, and their breaking of the law, and they're not carrying on the Sabbath. And the Sabbaths, they wouldn't carry on the Sabbaths of the land to give the land rest. So God's going to take them out and give it rest. And he did that immediately for 70 years. But he has done this to his people. They're all over the world now. But he goes on with a positive, though. And so these are words of hope for the Jewish people. So will I watch over them, just as he did in the past, but for different purposes, two different purposes. To build. He's going to edify them. He's going to build them up. And to plant. And so they're going to be planted, and where they will be planted, well, it's going to be back in their land. But they're going to be built up and edified, and they're going to be edified because he's going to provide for them in the new covenant. And they're going to have revelation, so they will be able to handle that. But it goes on to build them up, saith Jehovah, and to plant them. And so he will establish them back in the land. Now in verses 29 and 30, we have an individual judgment in those days. And so it goes on, when he does plant the seed in the house of Israel, in the house of Judah, he says, in those days they shall say no more, the fathers have eaten the sour grape, and the children's teeth are set on edge. And so they're not going to say that this was a bitter thing, something that would cause you to kind of pucker up. It was really sour event that has taken place as they were carried into captivity. And remember, if the nation as a whole, if they kept the law and observed the Sabbath and they worshiped Jehovah, they had the promises of blessings back in Deuteronomy 27, 28, 29. You have the Palestinian covenant in 29, 30, but you do have some references back there to a covenant there. But they could have the cursings or they could have the blessings. It was kind of their choice. And God gave them the option, and the potential was they could do what God said and be blessed, and they would be blessed. They would have health, they would have wealth, and it would cause them to be happy because God would provide for them. But when they were carried off, even those who were the ones who were born down in Babylon or up in Assyria, if they were born in captivity, they might look back at the bitterness of all of this and the sourness of the situation that came because of their fathers, and it was their father's sin and their father's perversity that got them carried away. And so here they are away from what would be their homeland, the land that was promised to Abraham. And so they're away, but yet, and it's not something that's, and it wasn't their doing. And so the fathers have done so, and it's affected the children, the sons. But then in verse 30, but everyone shall die for his own perversity. And so they're going to die, and the word iniquity would have the idea of their perversity, looking at that which produced the sin in their lives. But each one was going to die for his own perversity. So it wasn't going to be carried over because of what the fathers did in the future, but the ones, they would die because of their own. They were going to be held accountable for their own perversity. And so every man that eateth the sour grape, his teeth shall be set on edge. It was going to affect those who behaved in a way resulting from their sin nature, as they would do as the fathers did. And so it was their own. It was going to be personal judgment in the future, not based upon their fathers. And when it came down to going into the at the end of the tribulation, is a kind of thing before the establishment in the land. And as they enter in, people are going to pay for their own actions, and so it's going to be a personal thing, not a national thing at that time. I think that's what we see with the description of a man shall die for his own perversity. And so if he does participate and partake of that which is going to be bringing about a kind of a bitter, sour response anyway, he's the one that's going to affect him personally and not the nation as a whole. And so they will, but the days are coming when that will take place. But at this time, looking back prophetically and looking forward prophetically for Judah, the house of Judah, they will be carried off into captivity, and it's because of the condition of the fathers there in the land. Now, when we come down to verses 31 and down through verse 34 in particular, we come to what is referred to as the New Covenant. And the New Covenant, again, this is something that the pre-incarnate Son of God is going to, it says, Jehovah said, saith Jehovah, but the one who's meeting with Jeremiah, the one who is with him, the Word, the eternal Word who was to Jeremiah, as we saw a couple of chapters back in the last place where we saw that reference, he's the one who speaks again. But Jehovah is going to cut a new covenant. And he's going to cut a covenant. And notice we want to be very careful when we come to this. This is a passage that is probably the most used passage and sometimes the most abused passage in the book of Jeremiah. And when we come to it, we want to notice exactly what the words say. When it says who it's addressed to, and what's involved with it. And we will take it literally in context. And I think maybe we will spend a little bit of time sometime looking at into the New Testament, because in the New Testament we do find this referred to on probably three or four places at least, where we do find it in the New Testament anyway. We find reference to this. Though we do find it in a couple of places where it's contrasted with another covenant that's redefined as a new covenant. And so, do we have just because it's a new covenant, is it the same? Is every our word, just because it says new, it always has to be the same? Well, we're going to go through this, first of all, in the context, and We'll just kind of give us a surface survey of it, I think, this morning, and then we'll spend a little more time on it in the future. I'm not sure where we're going with Christmas coming up, but anyway, we plan to come in and look at this, and Chris can do it for us, and then we, since he's working on covenants a little bit, some too. So, but anyway, we will spend some time on this. But I want you to notice the one thing we see here: behold, the days come, and so it is prophetically. It's looking out to the future when he says, "Saith Jehovah." And so again, it's anticipating. And just to get the feel of the time frame of this, we're over in chapter 30 in verse 24. At the end, it says, "In the latter days, you shall consider it." And that's where you pick up the concept of days. And you do have the days come over in chapter 30, verse 3. And you do have some reference to days, but it's going to be in the latter days. And so it is moving out into all of these days are anticipating the prophetic future. And so he says, "Behold, the days come, saith Jehovah, that I will cut a new covenant." Now I translate the word make, cut. And so it is a word for that means to cut, not to make, but it's to cut a covenant. And we noticed back in Genesis 15 where it is where we saw that God cut a covenant with Abram, and they took the animals, cut them in two, and if you walk and you walk down through the ones making the covenant walked through and said, "May the same thing happen to me that happened to these animals if we should break the covenant." Now in Genesis 15, who walked between the animals? Only one. It was a one-sided covenant. It was an unconditional covenant that God cut with Abram while he was asleep. And Jehovah passed through between the animals, and he cut the covenant with Abram. And so this is where the idea of cutting of a covenant, that's what they would do in those days. And so God does say, he says, "I will cut a new covenant." Now, when you look at a covenant, what is a covenant? Just to make it simple, a covenant does involve promise, but not every promise is a covenant. And you find many promises in the Old Testament and in the New Testament. But when it comes to a covenant involves a promise, but it's a promise that's given on a solemn occasion. There's some solemn event. There's something that sets it apart from just an ordinary promise. And so all of the promises are important, but a covenant is set aside. It involves something very special and unique that sets it apart as a covenant. And so we find the cutting of the covenant. And so to make a promise, God made promises to Israel, and we see some promises of the return and such before this in Jeremiah. But you can go through the Old Testament, you do see promises. We see promises concerning the Messiah and concerning the one who was to come when Jehovah would come. We see those. Some of them have been fulfilled during dealing with his first coming. We have promises dealing with his second coming. They will take place. But much of prophecy hinges around the covenants. And so the covenants are important. And so we don't make promises to be covenants if they're not called covenants. Some do. And so they would find just a covenant is just a promise. But it's more than just a regular promise. It involves something like the cutting of the animals in those days. But it involves some solemn occasion. And it would be where God would swear by an oath that this would take place. So not every promise was sworn by an oath. But yet God would swear by an oath that this would take place, and he made a covenant. He would cut a covenant with his people. And he has cut a covenant with us. There are covenants that relate to us as well. But a lot of the history of the Old Testament and the prophecy of the Old Testament does revolve around God's covenants. And just to think about covenants, some find a covenant in the Garden of Eden, and after the Garden of Eden, you read through that, and if you can find it, then I'll believe it. But you won't find covenant referred to until you get down to Noah. And there were two places where God cut covenants with Noah, and he put a bow in the sky. On the final one, that he would not destroy the earth again by a flood. And so you have had a promise there, and it was a solemn event, and it's called a covenant. He made a covenant with him. We can go on. The next place you find it is in chapter 15 of Genesis. We don't find one in chapter 12, but if you read today about covenants and the new covenant and covenants, they find one Abrahamic covenant, and they find it in Genesis 12. If you find the word covenant in chapter 12, I will believe it. I don't like to eat paper, so I won't do like Dr. Schaefer said, and I'd tear the page out and I'll eat it if you find it there. I won't eat the page, but I would believe it if you find it, but it's not there. It's not in 12. It's not in chapter 13. There were promises. There were personal promises to Abram in both of those chapters. But you come to chapter 15, and there he does say that he cut a covenant in that day. But it was in that day that he did so, not before. And that's what it says in verse 18. And so you do have covenants. You move on, and you have the next covenant. What would be the next covenant? Well, we move over to Mount Horeb, to Mount Sinai. And we do find that in other places referring back to it as a covenant. In fact, we'll see it in a moment, if I move fast enough, we'll see that referred to as a covenant even in our context here. But you see, these were covenants that God established with different people. But now with the law, and beginning with Abram, his people, going through Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, it was a special covenant that was cut with those peoples, with his people, through Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and the 12 sons of Jacob. Then we go on down with the next one. The major one that we would see would be in Deuteronomy at the end there of chapter 30 and 20, 29 and 30, I think it is, but you have reference to what a covenant there. But it was different than the one that was at Horeb. We're told there, and it's a unique covenant. But that one relates to the implementation of the land promises, and it's a promise that concerning the land. And so, again, it's a future kind of a covenant. and we skipped over the other Abrahamic covenants, but when you come down to it, you have another covenant that's going to be cut with a family, with one man and his seed, and that's David in 2 Samuel 7. So these were solemn things. God swore by an oath that he would do them. And then we come to this new covenant. This is the new covenant with Israel. There are a couple of other ones that deal with priests and things and such. And then we will look at an eternal covenant with them. But it's these things relate to Israel. So anyway, a covenant's a solemn. It's a promise, but it's a swearing by an oath. But it involves a special solemn occasion or some solemn ceremony of some kind when it comes to a covenant. So as we come to verse 31, he says again, "Behold, the days are come, saith Jehovah, that I will cut a new covenant." Now it's a new one, and this new one is going to be contrasted with the one that's an old one. But notice the thing that's important here, a new covenant with the house of Israel and with the house of Judah and with the church. No, I guess it didn't say that. But that's the way a lot of people read this. They read it, they read the church into this new covenant. And we're not going to do that. It says with the house of Israel and the house of Judah. It doesn't say that he's going to cut a new covenant with the house of Israel and with the house of Judah, and that others in the future, the church, they'll just benefit by the spiritual blessings of the covenant. And so this is what people believe today. They want to apply it to the church and make the church's new covenant part of this. I'm just touching on it. Maybe we'll spend more time in sometime in the future. But anyway, he goes on and he contrasts this, though. Now, back in verse 27, in those days, this is going to be the days when he's going to sow seed in the house of Israel and the house of Judah, back up in verse 27. And so but at that time, he's going to cut a new covenant with the house of Israel and the house of Judah. But it's a contrast with the old covenant, not according to the covenant. It's not like the covenant that I cut with their fathers in the day that I took them by the hand to bring them out of the land of Egypt. And so that takes us back to what? It takes us back to Mount Horeb, to Sinai, and the covenant that was cut there, the law. And so you have the Mosaic Law was a covenant. He refers to it. He cut a covenant with them that day. And so when he brought them out of Egypt. But notice what they did with that covenant, which my covenant they broke. And they did that. They emphatically, they broke it. Although I was an husband unto them, saith Jehovah. And so he was married to them, to Israel. They became his people. And yet they broke the covenant, and by all the things that they did, they continuously broke that covenant, though. And all it would take to break the law was to break one thing. You were liable for the whole law. If you broke, you were liable for the whole thing. They got 10 commandments, and then they had a lot of other things added, statutes and judgments and things. But when they broke one element, one thing, it was enough if you lusted, if you coveted, a simple thing. If you just coveted your neighbor's ox, you broke the law, and so you were liable for the whole law. You broke the law. But they did it. They broke it in many ways, and often very severely they broke it. And the worst thing was they started putting other gods up there alongside of God. And they also broke the Sabbath, and they broke the rest of them also. They did that often. But God is going to cut a new covenant with them. And you have another reference in verse 33, but our time's running out, so we'll pick up there next time. We'll come back and just kind of introduce this with a bit of a review, but we'll come back and spend some time looking at this covenant and what's involved in it in the context here then we'll kind of look at it at the concept of a new covenant as we see it in the New Testament as well. So let's go ahead and we'll look to the Lord. Father, we're thankful again for your word, and Father, we're thankful for the distinctiveness of words and for the distinctiveness of peoples, that we don't need to confuse Israel and the house of Judah and the house of Israel with the church, that they're different. You have different promises. They have different promises. And in their new covenant, they have some promises that are good, that are really good. And yet when we get to the book of Hebrews, we see that though they had some things that are promised to them that are really good, that will be changes from the Old Testament and the Old Covenant, the law, yet we have something better that's promised to us, not because we're better, but just because of your grace and because of your plan. And it has nothing to do with us and how we are, but it all is your doing. And so we're thankful again that we live under grace, not under rules, and that we do have the indwelling Holy Spirit who can enable us to live the Christian life when we are spiritual and we begin to understand and be taught by the Spirit. And we're grateful again that we have different potentials than Israel did, and then they will even in the future. And so we're thankful again for grace. Amen.